Welcome back to On the Path as we continue season two with episode three, What is Lost? Lucy, how is the weather up there in North England?
It's actually pretty cold at the moment. I was thinking about this earlier today that somebody mentioned on my stream that they have missed our weekly weather updates between Texas and Newcastle. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
That was the first thing I wanted to get out of the way. We had to mark that off the check boxes. Are we going to talk about weather? We're talking about weather because it's freezing.
We're talking about weather.
Yeah, because it's freezing cold here. But where it is not freezing cold and where it is actually apparently really, really hot, and I'm jealous, is where our special guest for the episode today is. And who is that here joining us?
Oh, hello there. Well, my name is Tia, and Tia Beastie, some might know me as. I'm in South Africa right now. The weather is very hot, as you said, Brett. It's 40 degrees Celsius. And yes, I'm dying. but yeah, thanks for having me today. I'm excited to be joining you guys on the podcast you have going here.
It's great to have you.
Yeah, I think 40 Celsius, is that like 100, I think, Fahrenheit?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I think it is.
Yeah, I asked that as two people who don't use Fahrenheit. Would be.
I mean, 40 degrees to me is unheard of. Like, I feel like if it was 40 degrees in England, everywhere would shut down. Like, who wouldn't continue?
Yeah, and it's because I teach geography, and that's something I try to get. We're actually doing Europe right now, and I try to get that to the kids when they hear about heat waves in, say, like France or England, when it gets up to like what would be the high 80s here or 90 that people like die. And I try telling them, it's not Texas over there. They're not used to getting that, so they don't have air conditioning everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, Lucy, do you have air conditioning?
No, absolutely not. And obviously, all our houses are designed to keep heat in because it's usually cold here.
Yeah.
So when it's hot, the house continues to keep it in. So it just stays hot. That's why everybody goes into meltdown.
Okay. And like South Africa, it's pretty, I mean, it can get hot there. Obviously, not usually this hot, but it generally gets decently hot there. Is it?
Oh, well, it's ironic because unlike Lucy, our houses are designed to keep heat out. So because it tends to be this hot in the summer, actually can get hotter. But in the winter, it's getting colder and colder. I think it's global warming and our houses are not made for cold. So I have like three layers on in the winter, which isn't now, by the way, a beanie or next to the fireplace. And it is quite hellish here in South Africa.
Yeah, that's another thing, too, that I don't keep forgetting, but it's one of those, oh, yeah, you're in the Southern Hemisphere, so it's flipped. So you have hot Christmases, cold summers here, but obviously that's the winter for y'all. So, yeah, time zones and hemispheres and all that are fun, and they throw me off. But before we get started here, how about a quick intro of yourself, your background of The Witcher?
All right. Yeah, well, I started playing The Witcher 3 in 2016 when I was in my final year of high school. And I obviously just loved the game, favorite game of all time. And when I was done with the game, I found myself playing Gwent, The Witcher card game within the game. I got hooked on that as a card game. Never played card games before, by the way. Then CDPR, who obviously made The Witcher 3 game, they brought out a standalone version of Gwent, The Witcher card game. So I hopped onto the beta version of that. I've been playing it until now in 2022. I'm now casting for CDPR, which is just a dream come true. I would fly out to Poland if it wasn't for this whole COVID pandemic thing. So that hasn't happened yet, but that's still a dream I'm hoping to come true. I would love to visit Warsaw and, you know, see where the studio is based. And yeah, so I'm a streamer. I do YouTube and I cast the game for CDPR.
How did that come about, your connection there with CDPR and actually getting into official casting?
Yes. So firstly, I just started playing in the tournaments, not the official ones, but community tournaments. And I love the community, so I made a lot of contacts there, friends, and the smaller team started asking if I can help cast their little tournaments they were hosting. And so the tournaments became bigger and bigger. Lionheart and I became good friends. We teamed up, became a cast, a pair. And somehow CDPR liked what they saw. They contacted me. I didn't contact them. I didn't think I'd qualify, to be honest. So I was very surprised when that happened. And yeah, they had me on board now for about a year. And they want Lionheart and I to cast together. So it's quite nice. I never thought it would turn out this way.
Okay, so you are definitely the expert over here on Gwent. As we covered before, Lucy is really getting into it. So what would you give her, the one major piece of advice for her or other people that are not starting out? At least you've probably got, what, a couple dozen hours or so in, you think? Actually, got a lot more than that because we had the streams alone. Yeah.
Yeah, we did a couple of long streams, and also when I was stuck isolating over Christmas, that was pretty much all I did. So I've got a few hours in now, but I'm still very much rooted in Skellige. I haven't ventured out into any other factions or anything yet. And it was actually, I think it was your video, Tia, that I watched, your video that you put on YouTube for beginners. That was whenever I was at home sick in bed, I was just watching that video and like pausing it, trying out what you said, going back to it. And honestly, it was so helpful. So like, if any beginners are listening, Tia's beginner video is top class.
Yeah, and we'll have her YouTube channel down in the notes, especially we'll cover all that at the end. So you're kind of like a mid-level. So someone who's maybe like rank 15 to 18, Tia, what advice would you give to somebody like that?
I mean, I've seen Lucy's stream, and so far I can't really give advice. She's doing everything perfectly well. The one thing the Gwent community likes is someone who's passionate about the Witcher universe, and everything after that is extra. So obviously if you want to be a pro, you'd be playing every day for a year or two. But if you just go into the game with fresh eyes, you're enthusiastic. Gwent seems to get a bit stale every now and then with the community wanting changes. So a fresh player brings in that new perspective and shows people what they forgot is so amazing about the game. So yeah, just positivity, I'd say. And the fact that you like Skellige, you know, that in itself is really nice, you know, liking a faction for its lore or its playstyle. Yeah, so I can't give you much advice. You're pretty much doing everything right, I'd say.
I actually get a lot of people in my chat saying that they like seeing new players because they don't tend to play the meta, or they play like cards that people have forgotten about. So that's, I think, what people kind of enjoy about a new player.
Exactly. They love new blood.
Yeah, that's my thing too, is I only play Skellige now, and I only play Cambi. For that reason, because again, I don't stream that often. I'm not that big. It's kind of one of those, hey, this will be something somebody can watch. But I will also take it as a compliment that it's my coaching, right, Lucy?
Oh, 100%, yeah.
I will say, I think in the two times that we've co-streamed, I think you've only lost one game.
Yeah, we did pretty well.
Yeah, I think it was that just straight jackpot deck at rank 20 or something. It had to be someone just smurfing. And I was like, okay, yeah, we're not going to beat this deck. Okay, last thing before we get on, because this is more near and dear to my heart. I have mentioned that for the first time, I am teaching psychology. And Tia, what is your degree in? Your master's degree?
It happens to be psychology.
Wow, ooh. Look at that. So again, what really drew you to studying the brain?
It's interesting. I began studying law and a bachelor's in law, but I always did psychology as a major. So as I went through the years, I liked the law, but it was already written, and there's not much more to discover, really. It's just every day you look at what is already established by your society, and you have to maybe, you know, practice that in a court of law, which is interesting if you're a judge or so. But psychology, there's so much we don't know, and I absolutely love that. And I love to learn what is already predetermined and what isn't. So every now and then that you'd find this really interesting experiment, you know, something like the Stanford Prison Experiment or the bystander effect. I don't know, maybe some of you have heard about things like that. And you realize, well, would you act like that in a similar situation? And are you unique? What makes you as a human different? So now I'm applying to go into a master's in psychology. I want to do neuropsychology. So I want to learn what the brain is all about and what is actually similar in every human, so I can establish what's unique and what is not similar. So yeah, that's me. But very fascinated when it comes to psychology.
Just did a little project over the lobes and parietal, occipital, frontal, and temporal. So there we go. I remembered them. Again, I'm learning a lot of this as we go along. This is the fifth subject I've taught. And I've taught sociology before, but this is obviously vastly different to that. It's more individually. So, no, that's very interesting to hear. And again, there may be some times where I message you about certain things or what to do. Because, like, a big thing is to me is like linguistics also, like language acquisition. And that can just kind of have to do with some of these other really bad experiments that were done in psychology, like some 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah,
the history is like, oof, some of them, like, literally, I was going to talk with them to the class, but they were so. One was literally taking like newborn monkeys and purposely separating from their mother to see like what they do, like isolating them. And it would like drove them psychotic.
Yeah, it was to test whether they went for the milk or whether they went for the warmth. Well, there were several of these, but they made like two dummy monkeys.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And they wanted to see which ones the baby monkey sought out, the one with fur or the one that was cold but with milk. And I think the monkeys went for the warm fur instead of the milk, which is just so depressing.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Are do you teach high school grades or university?
Yeah, it's high school. So it's grades 10 through 12, which over here is roughly age like 16 to 18.
That's so interesting because all these subjects you're speaking of, we only have those in university. So it's so cool that you're teaching psychology in high school. We didn't have that.
Oh, yeah. And it also depends on the school. Like, sadly, if you're at a bigger school or a more well-funded school, you can have more of them, even though they're all public schools. So, yeah, this is their psychology. Like I said, I've taught sociology. There's also specifically like forensic science at this school.
Cool.
So literally that's what you do, because I talk with that guy and I'm like, hey, do you ever talk about like psychology? He's like, no, this is more like the physical stuff. If he's there again next year, I'm going to get with him and maybe we can somehow kind of like combine it. But like with that, you have to have a prerequisite of a law class. And there's a lot of trades. So, yeah, I mean, it's a very big school. There's almost like 4,000 people there. All right. Yeah. Very interesting. And again, I could pick your brain about psychology all day as we go on. I'm sure some people are just like, when are they going to get to the episode? Well, we're not getting to the episode yet, because first off, we ask that you please rate and review this podcast. You can now do it on Spotify. Last I saw, it's like a perfect 5.0, which I think like 24 reviews. So
yeah,
please do
so.
That. And also on Apple, you can not only rate it, but you can review it. And I've said before, if we get a 5-star review, I'm going to read it. And this one right here was great. And it comes from Gerard Speed. This is a really great in-depth podcast about one of my favorite games of all time, The Witcher 3. I love the format of breaking the game down into its individual quests, since there are so many ways the various paths in the game can branch out. But I think my favorite thing is both of their accents. Who would have thought that a Texas drawl and an English accent would blend together so well? Also, it doesn't hurt that they are both total cuties. So, again, thank you very much for that review. And Lucy, I will let you comment on the English accent.
I'm going to allow this and let it slide because they called us cuties, so I'm fine with it. But I guess it's fair because I don't ever think I properly introduce myself when I join the podcast. I'm actually from a small wee country called Northern Ireland, so I do have a Northern Irish accent. But I've lived in England for probably the last 10, 11 years. So I guess it does come across more as like a hybrid English accent. So the mix-up is allowed.
Yeah, we'll take it because it's saved at the end. And also, if you like those accents blending together, now we have a South African one thrown in. So we're expanding.
It's a great mix.
Yeah, a little bit.
We're going international here.
We are. Even more so. Yeah, we've got three different continents, three different time zones all over. That's what we're trying to do here. And I guess, Lucy, you don't know Afrikaans, do you?
No, I don't.
Okay. So now you have another language to throw in there as well. So, T, if you want to throw in some Afrikaans in there, knock yourself out, and we will just politely nod in the
scene. Yeah, all the Afrikaners for Stormy.
Okay, there you go.
I love it.
All right, so we also, there was one last month I forgot to mention. It was a 5-star review, and it was from Kryn. And if you are a Gwent player out there, you may know him. I think is he a mod in your channel, Tia?
He's actually not.
Okay.
But I know he's in every channel there is, so I'm playing hard to get here. I want him to earn it first.
That's exactly what I told him. I'm pretty sure he's up to like 22. And I told him like, so you're in so many, like, no, like it'll be fine. You're not being in mine. So good. We're holding out. But again, Kryn, if you're listening out there, again, thank you very much for that review. And anybody else who does it, if you leave that review, if it's a 5-star review, we'll read it off. If it's a 4-star or less, we will hunt you down and make Horson Jr. look like a saint. So, all right, last bit here. There will not be any spoilers for future episodes, and this will also not be a scene-by-scene rundown either, but rather major points of discussion, okay? So with that, let's get started here with episode 3, What is Lost? First thing to come up, Lucy, let's jump where you are. What is the first thing you have on there?
So the first thing that I wrote down was the Leshy / Myriapod fight. So it was essentially the big monster fight from this episode, which I know is Brett's favorite thing to discuss when we talk about any episode. So back in December, when we were sort of getting all the teasers and trailers for season 2, one of my favorite bits was the reveal that we were going to get a Leshy. So we got to see one in Nightmare of the Wolf, and it's one of my favorite monsters in The Witcher 3. I love the forest scenes that it comes into, and in the game it usually gets a pack of wolves running around it, but it just made me really excited to see it in the show. Obviously the first couple of episodes were teased with Eskel Leshy, and then we finally meet the Leshy in the woods, and it looks incredible. Like, to me, the design was perfect. I thought it was very similar to The Witcher 3, apart from it doesn't have legs, it seems to be like trunked in. So we get the reveal, and then it's almost immediately killed by this new monster, which is revealed to be the Myriapod, which Brett actually got to meet in real life in New York City.
I'd never really talked about that trip that I had, because mainly we were able to talk about it. It was kind of during our hiatus. And we will go super in-depth with it when we get Alyssa on the show, who was scheduled to be a guest. Mm. She was there, Breakfast in Beauclair, another podcast of The Witcher. And yeah, basically, long story short, was reached out to by a like freelance reporter who said she was trying to find Witcher superfans, kind of interviewed about a 15-20 minute interview, kind of why I like The Witcher and certain things about it. And she was like really into that I was a basketball coach, like a college basketball coach, sent some things, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, got invited to go to New York City to the Netflix offices and watch the premiere like several days early. And they flew us out there, got us like a driver to our hotel, paid for our hotel, gave us each $500, and then did all this. And we saw this kind of like pitched battle. I made a little Twitter thread about it, but I can put that again in the show notes as well. And yeah, the thing about it was incredible. But all that came out of it was like a 1 minute, 15 second video. And like barely anything was in there. And I just was like, man, I'm very appreciative. It's great. But I thought it's a lot to do that. But yeah, it was absolutely incredible. And I hope that we can somehow do it again. But yeah, when Alyssa comes on, we will really, really, really go in depth on that for sure.
Oh, I saw it. It was very quick, but it looks so cool. I would pay $500 to go. Let's put it like that. And you spent more than a minute and 15 seconds there. You did other things besides watching the premiere.
Yeah, honestly, as cool as that was, something I've always wanted to do was go to New York City during Christmas time. So we got to see the ice skating, we got to see the tree, Rockefeller Square. I think Saks Fifth Avenue has this light show just blasting this music all through the street. And yeah, like we were there, and like I said, we watched this premiere, and they did a sidewalk interview. And oh my God, I'm glad I remember this. This is the most New York thing possible. While I'm doing the sidewalk interview, so it's got this massive camera, these lights, everything. They interview me. When I'm done, I go talk to these two other people that are there also. And as we're talking, these two cops come up. Hey, did y'all hear anything that happened over there? And I'm about to say like, no. But then I think it was Alyssa just like, oh yeah, someone was getting mugged while I was giving my interview.
Oh, no way.
But here's the thing. I'm only laughing because of this. So this guy tried to do run by, like grab a woman's purse and take off.
Oh.
Well, she held onto it. And while this was going on, some other random dude comes up, punches or kicks this guy in the stomach. He apparently fell down and starts like yelling and like grabbing his stomach. And then they all just left. Then the cop,
no way.
Yeah,
I would have thought it's part of the show.
Well, that's the thing. Like, so if you look at the one interview, not the last one that they did, they ended up not putting any video of this. I tell people like, yeah, while this is going on, there's a real New York City like mugging going on. That might be the best story out of everything. But yeah, so that was going on. We watched this pitched battle. They walked us to where that Myriapod globe was, fight going on. They really show that in that video. Then they interviewed us again, and I talked with the Netflix people there. Coincidentally enough, one of the people who chose us is from Arlington, Texas, where I'm from, and went Aww. To a rival school. Oh, maybe that played into them choosing me. It was crazy. I cannot recommend New York Christmas time enough. It's just great.
The Myriapod in the, was it like a snow globe type thing?
Yeah, it was a snow globe, and they had this, there were free coffee, like hot chocolate, the drunken goat, I think is what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was that area.
I noticed there was loads of these Myriapod snow globes popping up almost all over the world, because I think there was one in Mexico City as well. And then it turns out there was actually one in a place, a city called Durham, which is about 30 minutes from me as well. But I realized too late. I only saw photos of it after it had left, or I would have went down to see it. So they really went all out advertising this Myriapod. But getting back to the scene where we see it in the show, it hunts down. So Ciri is told to run away. Geralt obviously isn't familiar with this monster, so he tells her outright, just run. And she does, thankfully. She does what she's told. But eventually the myriapod does hunt her down. And there's a bit where it backs her up against these rocks. But it seems to just linger a little bit too long, which made me think, did it actually want to hurt her or did it just want to find her? And without like spoiling too much from like later episodes, this is what just got me thinking that it didn't actually want to kill her. But then Geralt comes in and beheads it before we can ever find out. So did you have any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I noticed that too. And it's very eerie because as a viewer, I keep wanting to see what happens without all these people intervening. I want her alone with it and I want to see what happens, because what would it do? What's the next step to lead her somewhere? And again, as someone who hasn't yet read all of the books, I actually do not know. So I'm very curious to see where this ends up.
Kind of tap dance around where it is. But I will say this, because I think I've said it before. The monoliths are not in the books. Like, that's a complete show creation. So I'm just as curious to see that as well, what comes out with it. But I didn't know if it was a connection there. I just thought it might have been just television drama. That it's one of those, like, the bad guy gets to them and they hold the sword up real high, just enough time for the person to come in, like, shoot him behind, you know? I kind of thought that just might have been it. Tia, what did you think of the Leshy?
After reading some of the comments on Twitter, and so apparently Leshies aren't supposed to be able to put a seed in a human being and have them also turn into one, like Eskil did. Well, whatever he turned into, I'm not sure if it's technically Leshy himself, I'm not sure. But anyway, it was exceptionally cool to see. When the myriapod came, that was, to me, that was a plot twist, because I was expecting him to battle the Leshy, and then this thing, like you says, ripped off the Leshy's head, essentially. So it was pretty cool, and I'm very jealous that we didn't get any myriapods here in South Africa. Apparently, they can't handle the weather. It's understandable.
I think South Africa gets forgotten on a lot of things. I know that's a big thing with, like, game servers, right?
Yeah.
That it's
horrible.
Yeah, it's just
Twitch. It's we all have to restream on Twitch because we don't have our own dedicated server on Twitch. So we have to go through Amsterdam, which obviously is a mirror South Africa.
Really? So,
that's the closest one? Jeez.
Yes, it's really bad. So for a long time, I couldn't really stream any other games besides Gwent. And then I had to go through Amsterdam, and all of a sudden I can get better bit rates, if you will. Yes, we're not important enough, you see. Not important enough.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I live a lot of that through another South African Gwent creator, Jess. Yeah, she'll kind of put stuff in there too. I'll kind of look and see. She'll comment a lot about how, like, South Africa's forgotten. I'm just like, oh, okay. So she's my, like, go-to news source for South African gaming deficiencies. Yeah. I think that was another thing the problem has had, until you hit on it, was the Leshelski, whatever you want to call it. And then it's like, oh, here they are out there. It's Geralt and Ciri. It's the Leshen. And then, like, instantly it just gets cut in two and split. Oh, we didn't get to see what a lot of people wanted to see. So I guess that would be an understandable, I guess, problem with it.
Interesting. I wonder if it's a metaphor. Now, it's the first time I think about it that way. It's like, normally you'd battle Leshies, but all of a sudden you have all these new breeds coming out of nowhere. And it's just, you know, tears apart the Leshy. You've got these myriapods now coming from the, what do you call it? The things that aren't in the books.
Things that Istrid
studies. Yes, yeah. The monoliths. So, I wonder. But yes, I was very keen to see the Leshy being battled, but alas, the myriapod is good enough.
Lucy mentioned earlier the monster fights, they're okay, but when they're just done every episode, which at this point now is the third one, they just kind of get a little old. Maybe not old, but the tension's just not there, because we know nothing's going to happen to Geralt. We know nothing's going to happen to Ciri. Well, I should say we know. We're like 99% sure, because, again, this is its own story. They can kind of do whatever with it, but we know it's not going to happen. But hitting on the Witchers in general, kind of Ciri's experience and training at Kaer Morhen, so much of this was her on this obstacle course. The Witchers did not seem to be that much a help at first. They seemed to, again, still be very confrontational, if you will. And as I mentioned before, Lambert, I have on here that I do not believe Lambert is doing reverse psychology, because with reverse psychology, I think there's always something, at least there should be love behind it, or kind of a reason to do it. Like, if he cared about Ciri, he would be doing it. But Tia has a very good note on here that says, ignore him, Lambert is doing reverse psychology. Okay, so Tia, take it away.
I might have been just entertaining myself there while waiting for us to begin.
Okay.
But I, well, for me, it's, well, what's the alternative? If there isn't some motive here other than killing Ciri, what, you know, because that course is very deadly. Ciri's not a witcher. As we've heard, a witcher can crack open their skull, take some herbs, and they'll be fine, but Ciri isn't. And yes, so what was Lambert's plan? To have Ciri killed by this contraption, injured, or did he think she might be able to do it? And maybe there was a bit of tension there because he was blaming her sort of for the whole Eskil thing. I don't know why, but yeah, so he went and took Ciri. I'm hoping it's not to spite Geralt and to have her injured. So I'm hoping that he pushed her because Geralt wouldn't, and sort of egged her on and was maybe pleasantly surprised by the fact that she didn't give up. And in the end, you can see him sort of smirking as she's doing the whole course, hoping she does the landing at the end and just misses it. At least that's what I hope for. But you can convince me otherwise. I'm all ears.
Well, the thing is, like, I hope for that as well. And I definitely don't think he's trying to spite Geralt. But if they had a line between Cohen and Lambert, where Cohen is just like, hey, are you being a little hard on her? And he's like, no, she'll get it. She'll get it. She just needs to be pushed. Then we would, then I would be like, okay, then we know it's doing it. But there's nothing behind it. And then when she gets hit and falls off, he says something to the likes of, you don't belong here. You belong in a castle. And he's saying it with a very straightforward face. There's just been nothing in his character to show me that he's trying to encourage her. He's just a dick. Not even a dick, because that might be like a prick or something like that. He's just an asshole. I just did not get that he was doing anything other than trying to get her to leave.
Yeah, I agree. I sort of felt like he was trying to scare her away, because initially she's just fighting with the sack. What was the word for that?
Yeah, like the straw training dummy, and Lambert cuts it in half.
Yeah, so he like tries to threaten her or scare her with his sword and cuts that in half initially. Then takes her to this like Witcher equivalent of total wipeout and doesn't even like guide her on how to do it, just says go on ahead and try it. And then, like you say, when she falls off continuously, he's just an asshole. I didn't get, until we come back to this scene and he's suddenly giving her instructions, he's still being a bit of a dick, but he's actually showing her and guiding her at that point. But it just kind of came out of nowhere. I agree with you, Brett. It would have been nice to have a little line or something to show that he has motive behind what he's doing.
I think I may be overestimating his ability to sort of, how can I say, understand Ciri's mind state, because it's clear that she wants to prove herself. And if somebody really wants to get her to do something, they have to sort of make her doubt herself. Maybe that's an unintentional consequence, because he was trying to make her doubt herself as a little princess who belongs in a castle, but it worked, and she wanted to prove that she is meant to be somewhere, and she took the bait and did the course over and over and over again to her own detriment a bit there. I think in real life she would have been quite injured after those falls, in my opinion.
It was through an email on the Winds Howling podcast where someone compared the Witchers to a sports team or an athletic team, saying, oh no, he's really pushing them in that way. And again, as someone who's been an athlete since I was 4 and been a coach my whole adult life, including at the Division I, like the highest level of college basketball, you absolutely do that to some players. They need to be pushed that way. And if you doubt them, they'll be like, oh, I'm going to show this motherfucker right here. You do that as a coach, as part of a team where you care about that player and you want something out of it and you want them there to get better. If Lambert was doing this, if Geralt did it, then I'd believe it was in that vein, because Geralt obviously cares about Ciri more than anything. So if Geralt was doing this, hey, you can't do it. Or in a previous episode where he's like, all right, we're done, come in. Oh, I want to see if she really wants to keep going or not. But when it's Lambert in this vein right here, I just wasn't buying it. But by the end, and as you mentioned, Lucy, he kind of starts coming around a little bit. Cohen especially does, actually saying encouraging things. And then by the end of the episode, Cohen is actually training Ciri. And that was good to see, too, because in the books, they all really took on this training of Ciri. And Cohen was the one that always stood out to me, that really trained her. And in a way, kind of seemed like to be the closest one to Ciri outside of Geralt, but that just might be my way of remembering it. So at least the Witchers by the end came around, and all the talk about Eskil, Lambert to me is still just the most complexing character. I know we've talked about it, Lucy, but Tia, what do you think about Lambert? Because you've played the games, you played all the way through The Witcher 3, right? Like all of it?
Yes. Okay. Well, I haven't played the DLCs. I'm not on my way to do that.
Oh, man. Okay. Hearts of Stone. Me and Lucy talk about Hearts of Stone. We could, whenever we cover that, Hearts of Stone might last about as long as The Witcher main quest, because how much I think we're going to talk about that. Yeah. So again, yeah, just Lambert in general. What are your thoughts on him?
Well, you know that saying, Lambert, Lambert, what a prick. I do think it has some sustenance. I don't think he's a bad guy morally, but I can tell he's not exactly, you know, mature in that regard. He's very rough on the edges, and he intends to rub people up the wrong way. It's absolutely done on purpose as well. And it's the same with Ciri. I think some of it was a bit unfounded for sure. There's some comments he makes, I think, at the dinner table that one night where Ciri storms off afterwards. Yeah, very uncalled for, with no purpose other than just being horribly rude to somebody and hurting their feelings. Yeah, I'd say it's someone who needs to grow up a little bit, but hasn't had the need to because he's a Witcher, and who's going to stop him, right? Nobody in the bar.
Yeah. I think in Witcher 3 we get the little story how he became a Witcher, don't we? And he seems incredibly resentful towards it. So maybe in the show we'll get a little glimpse into that as well, and to show why he's such a prick.
That was one of my favorite things that the games did, was that backstory of Lambert, because it can tie into him why he's so prickly. But I think it's something I need to explain a little bit more, especially maybe people that don't, because this is more maybe in American slang or something directly to that. When I call someone like a dick or a prick, they're like prickly. They can be like quick. It's roguish. Think of like a Han Solo type, where they just might not care about a lot of things. Deep down, they can have like a heart or whatever like that. And like an asshole is just like a bad person that is doing it because they're a jerk. And so Lambert from the books, the biggest thing on him is he's just a real dick to Triss when they get to Kaer Morhen. Like completely, to where I think it's like Eskel and some other ones are just like, will you chill? And then the games did a great job of showing that as well. It's just in the show, I'm not getting that lovable prickishness that you get from the games. I just get an asshole.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. And I know one thing on here is a lot of the mages. And Lucy, you have down that you want to talk about Yennefer. I know, T, you got some things down on there as well. So yeah, Lucy, take us away with Yennefer.
Okay, yeah. For me, this was a big standout episode for Yen. Initially, she makes her dramatic re-entrance at Aretusa, and then she kind of begins re-establishing her relationships with the other mages. So first and foremost, she gets back together with Tisea, which is like incredibly emotional, and we'll speak more about Mianna Burring later. But one of the first things that kind of me curious was to say a thanks Yennefer for her sacrifice at Sodden, and it kind of, I wasn't sure whether it's known that you will lose your powers if you take part in fire magic, and why is it banned in the first place? Brett, you might know, I'm not sure. Is it just that it's super dangerous, or is it too powerful that it's just agreed that you won't do that, or is it because you will lose your powers?
Oh, I don't know.
No,
that's her losing her powers is not from the books.
From what I can remember,
fire magic is not banned. There are certain villains, one that we have not seen yet in the series, but it's coming up very soon, and another one who should be in the next season. They are very much tied to fire magic. So yeah. I think it's just more or less fire just destructive, and just destruction in general is just seen as bad. The whole Yen losing the powers was an interesting angle that they have introduced.
It was interesting. I think it made for a good... I know a lot of book readers especially really hate what happened to Yen this series, but without knowledge of the books, I guess I can just have a fresh perspective on it. I thought it was a really good storyline for her. It kind of showed how desperate she was for power and how it was literally everything to her. I think at the end of this episode, there's another great moment with her and Tisea where she says, I'm nothing without it. And it's just heartbreaking to me. Like, I thought it was a great arc for her. Secondly, she moves on to reunite with the other mages. So she meets up with Triss, Sabrina, and this unknown sorceress. I don't know if I'm supposed to know who she is or if she's a character that we're going to meet later on, but she just kind of felt like she was thrown in there for no reason. Am I supposed to know who that is?
I don't know. It's kind of like the Witchers, you know, they're just, we need more people in here.
Yeah.
Maybe someone had a good agent to get back there in the background.
Maybe she won a competition or something. But it feels as though there was a little bit of tension between Sabrina and Yen there. It's like she was extremely happy to see Triss. She was happy to see Unknown Sorceress. And then there was a little bit of back and forth between her and Sabrina. And I wasn't sure if this was her, because I've heard from the books that there's a little bit of rivalry between the two of them in terms of having a crush on Geralt. And I thought maybe this is them setting up a little bit of a love-hate relationship between the two of them.
I said I wasn't going to get hot. I adjusted the mic levels to where I'm not going to get hot. This, there is, in the book, Sabrina and Yen are like rivals. And like Sabrina's just very much this just hot mage, kind of catty. She makes comments about Geralt to Yen about, like basically she just wants to fuck him. And it's great. I love Sabrina. Okay, so what this is just one of my very annoying TV and movie tropes of the two people see each other. They fake like they don't like each other. And then, and they hold that tension like we're supposed to be like, And I'll admit, it kind of did fool me because I'd forgotten about their relationship in the show compared to the books. And I just was like, oh, yeah, they're rivals. Oh, wait, they're not rivals in the show. I don't know why they didn't introduce that angle. Maybe they'll have it coming up. I don't know. It's just one of those tropes that just annoys me. Just maybe because I just watch too much and think too much about how stuff gets created, writing and whatnot. I don't know. Were y'all as annoyed as it by me, or is it just me just being prickly about this episode?
The only thing I know of Sabrina as a viewer is I remember the little worms made by Fringilla, the dark magic. Somehow that was distributed by Sabrina, but she was sort of possessed by them.
Yeah.
And they had the little boys, and they blew up that whole tower in season one. And she did she attack Yennefer as well? I can't recall.
Yeah, she did. Like the brain worms, she attacked Yen, yeah.
Yes.
She stopped her, I think.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Exactly, and they fell. And so for me, as someone with no context of a friend-enemy relationship, maybe in the future, maybe not, I thought maybe they, you know, it's, I don't know, maybe there was some tension because of that fight previously. Mm. Maybe they specifically used Sabrina for that part in the first place to be the one to attack Yennefer in the tower. But yeah, I don't watch enough shows for that trope, no, Brett. but you have a keen eye.
Well, that, and as I mentioned before, I got into TV writing for like a couple of years, so there's so much of that that happens that I'm just more in tune to that I don't want to be. But going back to Sodden, I know, because Lucy, you have mentioned on here the return and the 13, that Tisea is writing out the 13, and that is one of those things that I absolutely love, is the 14th of the Hill, which that is Triss's nickname from the books, and they actually mentioned the games as well, because it was kind of her defining like moment. If she was the 14th of the Hill, she was supposed to be dead at Sodden. Everyone thought she was dead. So her name went up on this like monument that she had died, and she hadn't. And so she's always kind of lived with that and taken this, you should be dead. And Triss actually kind of mentions in this Wizardall meeting that she talks about her scars, and she was absolutely scarred up at the top. And they showed that in the show, and it was a major thing. And it actually says in the books that she will never wear a low-cut top again because of it. And I guess CDPR missed that because
they didn't get the memo.
They did not get that memo, because outside of like Triss's main Witcher 2 like outfit, it is plunging necklines like you can't believe. But again, I guess that was decision making that they might have made. But she says, what's lost is lost, and to find a new way forward. So much is maligned when you talk about Triss and the actions of what she did. And it doesn't look like they're going to include from the books a lot of the problematic part, like the main problematic part. And so her character is a lot different, but she wasn't on that. And so she's not going to be the 14th of the Hill. And that was just something I really liked, because it really just played into her psyche that she carried this in a name, like, you know, Geralt has the Butcher of Blaviken that he carries with him, and it kind of defines him, even though it may or may not be true. And Triss kind of self-carries this 14th of the Hill. She talks about it at Kaer Morhen in the books. It's one of my favorite scenes. They kind of hit at it in a little bit different episode, where she starts to talk about Sodden and the wars, and the witches are all, shut the hell up, we don't want to talk about that. And she's like, no, you're going to hear about it, and gets super emotional mentioning the names. She mentions Coral getting her arms and her legs like ripped off as she's just screaming in this like melting pile. And I wish Triss kind of had those moments, because it kind of makes her character a lot different and a lot more relatable, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm kind of glad that they put in the scars and they talk about that, but I do wish that they kind of would have included a little bit more of that personal stuff for her character.
So do you think possibly Yennefer might take on that 14th of the Hill kind of mentality at all?
If she was meant to be dead. Yeah, because she did put her name on there, didn't they?
Mm-hmm, yeah, I think it's the very first scene you see Tisea writing it, and she's like in tears almost.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. But by the end of the episode, they actually have the monument up.
Yeah, and yeah.
Obviously, because Yen's there to behead Kaer, which
they know.
Which, that's a whole other thing to talk about, Kaer, but yeah, we can cover that later. To hit on the Brotherhood, I keep wanting to call it the Lodge, but we're not there yet, and that's where the games kind of start to blend in. Tisea, I know, Lucy, you brought up Myanna Burring, and I almost interrupted you, because every time that name gets brought up, I want to talk about her, because she's just amazing. And yeah, just she's back in here. Her role is greatly expanded. I love that it is because she's an amazing actor. The character's great. Anya Schlotcher's a great actor. Her character's great. And anytime those two are together is just when the show is, to me, almost at its best.
Yeah, I feel like you can feel all of her emotions in this episode, like when she's not speaking as well. So like when she's, like we just said, when she's carving Yennefer's name, when Yen returns, when Yen says that she's nothing without her magic, and at the very end, when Yennefer releases Cahir, it's all Mayanna Baring's face is just, it says a thousand words. And I just think, I agree, she's such an incredible actor, and I'm so glad that Taseya has become more of a main character in this show.
I totally agree. She's one of my favorite characters by far. I had no idea of her significance with regards to the books, but the show brought it out quite nicely, how you know, just that presence in the room, and I quite like it. And the one thing about Yennefer that you guys keep saying about her powers being everything, she's nothing without her powers. She had a moment, Yennefer, in season one where Taseya appeared in her room and she said, "What more do you want?" And Yennefer said, "Everything." Mm. And it made me lose a little bit of sympathy for Yennefer at first, because to me that felt so materialistic from what we're shown, at least in the series. And like nothing can be enough. And then finally she lost everything. It's not enough for her. She doesn't move on. Let's not jump ahead. But she definitely wants the power back almost at all costs, because she's nothing without it, right? So I truly hope she grows in the next season as a person, someone who's willing to sacrifice themselves.
Yennefer is just kind of interesting all around, because as great as like the character is, as you mentioned, it can be kind of inconsistent, because all she wanted was power. But was that individual power? Was it to be a powerful mage, or was it power over kingdoms and to control all of that? And then a huge thing was, obviously, she wants a child, and that now doesn't seem to really be the case, because now she has bigger things, I guess, bigger fish to fry, being the get the magic back. It's kind of in that same as the season goes on and into the next season, again, if you've already seen it, to be more, I guess, more consistent, I guess, was that fair? I mean, that might be a talk for the end of the season when to talk about everything.
Yeah.
But I guess, do you think that that she's been inconsistent?
I get what you mean, yeah, because the whole first series is kind of about her wanting to, she always wants something. So first of all, she wants, you know, to get this transformation, and then she wants a child after she's had the transformation. It seems she gets one thing and then something else is taken from her and she wants a different thing. So she wanted a child. At the end of the series, she's kind of come to terms with not being able to have a child, then something else is taken from her. She wants that back. So yeah, it's like there's always something else that she wants, and she doesn't seem to have one sort of like life goal. This is what I need. This is what I want. She just always wants something. And I don't know what, if she was to get all these things, what would she then do? Would she just want something else? Probably.
In the books, there's one thing that she really wants and has to do. It's so far very different in the show right now, in the season right now, and the episodes that will come up. So again, we'll kick the can down onto that later. Going back to everything that makes her is this magic, and without it, she's nothing. And kind of related again to the previous thing about something about athletes, that can happen also with high level athletes when they have to retire, or when they lose that step and they're not what they once were, they lose their sense of self-worth. And so with Yen here, we're seeing she has no self-worth. What is her meaning of her existence if it's not magical? Like, what can she do? And I think that just might lead her, or can lead her, to an interesting tale of, it can be either a depression or something in that we did not get from the books. So with that, I'm actually kind of glad they put in to explore that a little bit more.
For me, when it was quite interesting, her obsession about the child, wanting a child, because it never seemed like she wanted one until she heard she can't have one anymore, and then she wanted one. So she was obsessed with what she can't have, and very interesting about her. But it's that, I want to say, is the only thing that's sort of consistent, is her wanting more throughout the series so far. Perhaps deeper down, the consistency seems to err as what she's willing to offer in order to achieve what she wants. You know, her priorities, do they lie with Geralt, with Ciri, with the Brotherhood, Saya? That I'd still like to see a little bit more in the future.
Vilgefortz is another big one. He seems to play a much smaller role this season overall, but especially now. It does seem to be, at this point, there is a power struggle with Stregobor and Vilgefortz. And Vilgefortz kind of has this alliance with Taseya. And in, I guess, a lot of fashion, they're going to give the man credit for this victory that a woman did, because politics require the certain type of person. You know, Yennefer kind of says that and understands. But when they kind of come across each other, we get this, it's kind of cold, a little bit of Vilgefortz there.
Well, so far, not much. He's always been a little bit shady to me in season one, at least. But season two, it was interesting to see Tosea and Vilgefortz sort of connection and how they wanted to have more political control. It will be interesting to see what they do with it once they have it. And yes, I don't know, I'm not a fan of having to lie to get what you want. To me, if you have to lie to get what you want, you don't deserve to get it in the first place. And having to pretend like you were the one who used fire, like Yennefer did, to get voted into power, to me, that's a slippery slope to a bad outcome.
I was thinking, if you were to have, for whatever reason, only watched season two of the Netflix show, you maybe would kind of think he was like the man. But then I just keep thinking back to Sodden, and there's not been any references so far back to what he did at the end of the Battle of Sodden, where he kills the Northern Realm soldier. So that's kind of just been forgotten about, or are we supposed to forget about that? I'm not sure. Like you say, Tia, I don't have many thoughts on him so far, apart from that sort of niggle in the back of my head where I'm thinking he did this, but I'm not sure if we're supposed to trust him now. He's a great actor. I think he really looks the part, very commanding, like in that last scene, which I think is amazing, at the execution scene. I love that, and it's all lit by fire, and he's given this speech to the kings, and I think he says, "This is what strength looks like," and I just thought, wow, he's great.
Another thing too is he fought Kyre at the end of the battle. And Kyre defeated him, and that's kind of what sent him down that hill. He wakes up and he kills it. That's something also that I would love to know why they put that in, where Vilgefortz kills that Northern Realms guy. And then, like you said, they never hit on it. The other one, last one here, Stregobor, much bigger character in the show. He is literally only in The Lesser Evil, that book, the book story with Renfri, and then he never comes back. So he's massive here. He's one of the leaders. I know it's like Artorias is like the leader, but now it's this little power struggle there we mentioned with Stregobor. Stregobor is very much a racist dickhead. He does not like elves. He wants pure blood. It's very on the nose and can be annoying, but it is one thing, it's a pet peeve of mine with a lot of the Witcher fan base, is they don't seem to understand that maybe even the main theme of the Witcher books is intolerance and racism. And that is bad. Not that that is not good. So much of it is literally showing not only apply to the elves, of everybody. I mean, Geralt gets basically ridiculed everywhere he goes because he's an outcast, because he's a mutant. And it's just this intolerance from people who don't know about it. And then they perpetuate their own stereotypes, like, I don't have emotions, or I'm a lone killer. And it's like, well, no, you're only saying that because people treat you like that. And it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so with this being so on the nose,
in The Witcher, there's a lot of characters where they're kind of like a bit morally ambiguous, and he is just not one of them. I think he's just one of those characters. I just know I don't like him. I don't like his intentions. I don't like what he's about. Like you say, he is essentially a racist against elves. And yeah, in this episode, we see him kind of like fear-mongering with this group of students, and he tells them this story about another woman called Falca, and he's trying to make them... He's using the story to try and make them afraid of Yennefer. And then he also goes into kind of using... sort of trying to manipulate these people, saying that he's just trying to protect everyone. But to me, it just kind of seems like, firstly, he hates elves, so he just wants rid of Yennefer at any cost. And she's only a quarter elf, so I'd hate to think how this guy would treat actual elves. And he also probably just doesn't want Vilgefortz and Tosea to get into power. So yeah, I just think he's all around bad guy.
What I was always wondering is whether he really was, he really had this hatred for elves, or whether he was using that general racism in the public to just get more control over people. So maybe to hype them up and to convince them that Yennefer shouldn't be there. Maybe he doesn't care about the fact that she's an elf, but he knows other people will care, and that's just a means to an end. At least I'm just wondering how you could possibly be racist against the elves. They're so wonderful. But for me, it just felt like this propaganda just to get more control. And especially when he was panicking, having been caught while trying to infiltrate Yennefer's mind, and immediately jumping to, oh, she must be a traitor then. Yeah, so I don't trust him either, though. Not at all.
I think that could also be just maybe their own little meta commentary, at least on, like, American politics, if you will, of playing up, like, racist populism that could be that way.
Yeah.
Because definitely, he definitely sees Yen as a threat to either power or whatever. But it's another thing that is played up so much more in the show is Yen being with a quadroon, a quarter elf. She is canonically in the books. I don't ever remember it ever really coming up to anything significant, but they're really playing it up. Like, Yen tries to play herself off as an elf to Francesca and the elves, and they, you know, they just smack her back down, deservedly so, when that happened. A way to gain power or a way to get the other ones play off fear. So, yeah, T, I think that's a very good point. And I did get a lot of Harry Potter vibes here. It was just like mud blood and like tainted blood. And I just was like, okay, because I've been on a massive Harry Potter kick because of that reunion that came out. And I know that y'all have seen it. So now we're going to take a detour what we do here. It's unplanned, but it's like, oh, yeah, Harry Potter. Oh, yeah, massive. I know, T, you're massive Harry Potter. You certainly have seen the reunion by now, right?
You're not going to believe this, but...
What?
I'm such a fan. Sometimes I avoid these things until I feel I'm mentally ready for it, because I will think about it for weeks to come.
Okay.
It's the weirdest thing, but it's the same with, like, rewatching the Harry Potter series. I don't watch it at all because I know I'll become obsessed for about a month. I know this is interesting. Interesting fact about Tia.
But you've seen the movies though, right?
Of course, many times as a child.
Okay.
And then I take like year breaks and like just not watch it at all because I will obsess about it. I've watched number 1, 2, 3, 4 so many times.
Those are the only ones that I will rewatch because the other ones are just so sad and I want happy Hogwarts.
Yeah.
I want happy, fun Hogwarts. But I will say this, you are correct in not watching it yet. I literally watched it the day it came out. And then watched it the next day because it was just that it was that good as a documentary, not just because it was Harry Potter, but the way they did it to me is like exactly how you do this. You don't have a dozen people out on a stage and talk to them one at a time. You do it movie by movie. In this case, it was always two movies at a time. Like the first one was perfect because Chris Columbus directed both of them. And you have like Chris Columbus and Harry and they're back on like a set and they're talking about it. And then you have the big three, Hermione, Ron and Harry, and they're talking. And then you have like Draco and the other ones. And the way they did it was just so good that if you will absolutely obsess over it when you watch it.
Oh,
so,
you will.
So make sure you have like a week, maybe weekend or at least maybe a week to maybe watch it a couple of times. So it might be that way. But Lucy, what did you think of it?
I loved it. Like you say, whenever I heard that they were doing a reunion show, I was kind of like, man, I'm not sure how I feel about this. Is it going to be like the Friends one? Which I didn't really enjoy that much. I wasn't a massive Friends fan ever. And there was another show, I don't know if you guys have it where you're from, but there was a show in the UK called The Inbetweeners. And there was like 3 or 4 series and it was a massive hit show here. And then they did a reunion show and there was a massive build up for it. And the reunion show was terrible. and everybody hated it. And it was like such a disappointment. So when I saw the Harry Potter one coming out, I was like not getting excited at all. I didn't even watch it for about 2 weeks when it came out.
Wow.
But like you say, it was amazing seeing all those young, these people that we saw grow up, basically just having their conversations and reuniting. It was so good. And there was stuff because I went to the Harry Potter studio tour in London a few months ago where they recorded this. This reunion I think is there because that's where all the sets are. So I was watching it with my friend who I went to London with going, oh my god, we were there. And it was just like, I felt like a kid again. It was just lovely. So I agree, if you're gonna obsess over it, you need at least a week.
I mean, I once went to London on a little tour to Europe with my friends, and first thing we did was go to the little platform 9 3/4.
Aww.
Our parents warned us not to buy ones, and that's exactly what I spent all my money on. It was a replica of Hermione's one. And it was so cool. But the rows were so long. I was so shocked to see there wasn't a platform 9 3/4 to begin with.
No.
Big shocker. We didn't go on the real tour, though. That was totally outside our little Europe tour. It was a high school thing, so that's on my list to actually go to the actual place. I think that's what you did.
I would die.
Yeah,
you'll love it. We went to Halloween time as well, so it was all dressed up with all, you know, the candles and the pumpkins and stuff. They do an amazing job. They change it up all the time, so it never really gets boring. You could go 2 or 3 times and see totally different things.
the game, what was it called? The Hogwarts game that is supposed to come out this year. Hogwarts Legacy.
That's going to be great.
It is, but at the same time, how can it possibly be as good as the expectations? You know what I mean?
I know. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Because it said like you can go outside of Hogwarts, like Hogsmeade. That's the number one thing. I want to go to the Hogwarts Great Hall, like at Christmas time. And then I want to go to Hogsmeade at like Halloween time or something like that. That's where I just want to live.
I just want all the magical creatures. That's my jam. I want to see all the creatures. And J.K. Rowling can make any creature. It's like she can dream one up while going to the bathroom. I will obsess over that creature. It's real now. It exists. So yeah, battling creatures. That's what I want to be doing. Well, finding them. I don't want to harm them.
I'm going to say, dang, we got Witcher Harry Potter over here.
Yeah, we're totally opposite of the Witcher here.
Combining it. There you go. Okay, so real quick, favorite movie. Which of the favorite movies? Lucy, what's your favorite movie of it?
We were talking about this at work the other day. How funny. It's definitely a toss-up between Goblet of Fire, because I feel like, apart from the ending, it's kind of like your perfect Hogwarts year. Obviously, the ending's very dark. The ending's where shit gets real.
Just turn it off before then, like I do.
Yeah, just close. Just turn it off then. But I love all the different schools that arrive, the different challenges they do. I love that Harry, the ball as well. I love that that's them sort of getting into their teenage years. I just thought it was like, I think for me, especially when I first watched these, I was that age. So I really felt like I could relate to them, and it was like what I was going through in my personal life. But it's always, for me, favourite is a toss-up between Goblet of Fire and the final film, Deathly Hallows Part 2, just because it's so epic and I have very fond memories of seeing it in the cinema. And it was the first time I'd ever been in the cinema where people were literally cheering. So they were cheering when, any spoilers, this is a spoiler alert, when Neville kills the snake, when Harry kills Voldemort, and then at the very end there was just a round of applause. Everyone was stood up cheering and I was like in tears. Like, I must have been 17 at this point, but I was like, it's finally done. But also that feeling of emptiness after. I was like, this has been 10 years of my life. What am I doing now?
What about when Bellatrix was killed? That had to get a roar.
That was another good bit. Yeah, amazing.
Okay. All right. Tia, what about you?
Oh, it's definitely Prisoner of Azkaban. Now, I don't know if my opinion is at all here biased because I had only some of the games growing up, and that was my game. I played that game on PC, so it collected every single card in the game. Maybe that's where the Squint thing started, and all the beans, and damn, I just love the time travel aspect, and the Hufflepuff tier. Why does it sound the same? The thing we ride, it's
Hippogriff. No, it's not hippogriff, is it?
It's a hippogriff, yeah.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Yeah, I had a little bit of a slip there. Buckbeak. I just love it. To me, it's a perfect age as well for me. It takes me back to my youth. Maybe I watched it at a certain time in my life where, I don't know, it's somehow sentimental now, but yes, that's the one. Number three. Dementors as well. Yes. Yeah. So Expecto Patronum, that one is also quite fun for me with the wardrobe and everything. Yeah.
Azkaban is up there. That also seems to be, when I ask this, the most common one. But to me, it's because the director, Alfonso Cuarón, like just an unbelievable director. He did Children of Men. If you have not seen Children of Men and you like dystopian stories where it's a guy and a girl kind of going around, it is unbelievable. A great movie. He's an unbelievable director. It would probably be that one, but I agree, Lucy. Goblet, I love competition. Again, the athletics part, so the Triwizard Tournament was great. The teenage angst can just be a little uncomfortable because, again, I just want people happy. I just want everybody happy. And like Ron and Hermione, Ron, you're a teenage boy, but it makes so much sense because maybe I see a lot of Ron, and when I was a dumbass, angsty teenage boy. Also like the hairstyles at that time, because I believe that movie came out in 2005. And despite the current look, at that time, my hair was down to about my shoulders. It was very long, and I used like a curling iron, a straightening iron to actually get it because it was so long. So I don't know if I have any pictures of that, of those. I think I just didn't like my picture taken, but so they'll always bring me back to the mid-aughts of just long hair. I know I said the last thing there, but obviously if we're talking about this, we have to get the houses. So Tia, what's your house?
Gryffindor. I know it's cliche, but that's me to my core.
Hey, if it's you, it's you.
Yeah, no, it's like 100. Like my high school experience is just a lot Gryffindor. Like I was also you know, fighting the teachers and got voted to head girl. And I was like the people's person. I was fighting their fights for them. And it's like, it wasn't about popularity, but it was about that doing the right thing, you know. And then
courage.
Yeah, but I love the fact that it's like you've got the Ravenclaws and they're more smart, and the Hufflepuffs and they're more, you know, and Gryffindor is all about, yeah, you know, you're not necessarily the smartest. You're going to fight, you know, you're going to go do the thing. But yeah, and you, Lucy, what are you?
I am a Hufflepuff through and through. Yeah, every test I've ever taken comes back Hufflepuff. And now it's been so long since I've done a test, I can't remember why I'm a Hufflepuff. I think Hufflepuff and Gryffindor are kind of similar, right? But there's just more, maybe a Hufflepuff might be like the second in command to a Gryffindor.
You're also focused on friends,
yeah.
Like the connections. But for you, it's way more important than for Gryffindor. But that you're just the most friendly house there is. Everybody wants to be friends with the Hufflepuffs.
There you go.
Because yeah, the way I always took it at was Hufflepuff was like the least of like the leading or like in charge. It would always seem to be that it would be obviously Gryffindor or Slytherin for different reasons, and then if it would be like a Ravenclaw, because again, to round this out perfectly, we need a fourth. I always get Ravenclaw. Like, I'm just straight Ravenclaw. Yeah, because it's going to be just thinking mind. Mm-hmm. I love like lateral thinking puzzles. I love detective movies. I love things trying to figure things out. And so that always went there. And like wisdom, like that's the number one thing. It's not really knowledge. It's not really intelligence. It's always wisdom. And again, that's just the faux philosopher in me that I never quite finished. Yeah, the difference is in there. It's like these very broad personality tests to get, again, going back to like psychology. Good, we got a good mix here. Does anybody know, any of y'all know a Slytherin we can bring in for a fourth?
We need a Slytherin.
Hmm. Oh, I know them. I know.
I know people who I'd want to call Slytherin, but they might not be it, and that might be an insult.
Oh, no. No, no. Slytherins are very proud. This is the one thing I know. Whenever somebody says they're Slytherin, they're very proud of it. So
I guess
that's how you know they're a Slytherin.
True. But I guess what I meant is someone who I think might be a Slytherin, but they're actually like a Gryffindor. And if I call them a Slytherin, they'll be like, oh, wait, what are you trying to say?
Oh.
If they are a Slytherin, you're right. They'll own up to it. I don't want to call them that and be, oops.
Your common room is the most scariest one, though, Brett, the Ravenclaws. What I read is in order to get in, you didn't have a code you had to memorize. You have to every single time do you have to answer a question that the portrait asks you.
It's a riddle, right?
Yeah, like, what if you just want to pop in real quick and use the bathroom and you have to answer a riddle? It sounds horrible.
That's one of those things that's very cool when you're world building, but in practicality, it would be really, really, because you're right, like, oh my God, I have to get back to either go to the bathroom or for something life and death. And they're like, no, answer me these questions today. It's like, oh my God, like, I just want to go to the bathroom. That might want to get me out of Ravenclaw if I actually had to do it. But maybe in that game, you might have to do that every time. That would be interesting. That would be really annoying.
Find a guide on YouTube of someone who did every single one of it. I remember times when guides weren't a thing and dial-up internet was, and not allowed to use it because it's expensive. And if I was struggling with a game, that's it. You're stuck on that level. Like, I still have a game I never completed. I can't even remember its name. But then years later, you find the thing and it's like, mind blown. Like Crash Bandicoot 4, I don't know if any of you played that. They had these, no, not 4, sorry. Just Crash Bandicoot number 3 with the time theme. And anyway, there's this one level with a secret entrance to another level. And I never knew about that my entire life until I Googled it the other day. And I put it on the PS4 and played it. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
And again, that's something when I talk, oh yeah, back in my day. But I do think when it talks about like me liking to solve problems and the challenges, is I remember the 80s, and I remember like regular Nintendo. And a lot of these regular Nintendo games, to actually beat them would only take like 30 minutes, 45 minutes to an hour if you know what you're doing. But when you're a little kid, you don't know what to do. They did have guides, but I wasn't going to go buy a Nintendo Power. I couldn't just Google an answer. And so me and my brother would spend hours, days, trying to get past this seemingly impossible game. And it was either quit or keep going. And that's the thing. I do it now also. If I get in trouble in anywhere in a game, I just look it up because I'm like, I don't want to deal with this. But I do think that played into me looking at stuff like that as a challenge. And it is something that nowadays you'd have to have a lot more discipline, because you'd actually have to not pick up the phone to look at it. But those early Nintendo games of just over and over and over, I didn't even like the game anymore. I just had to beat it because it was a challenge. And so that was something, again, that you bringing that up brought back a fond memory of childhood for me.
Like, just the other day, actually, I'm not going to get it now, but Harry Potter number one, the first game, I remember as a child, I also never completed the game. I just didn't. Like, at some point, I just didn't know what to go do anymore. And now, as I'm older, I bought this little book that actually tells you every little thing. And it's like, all of a sudden, I get to battle Voldemort, and I get to go against the ghost, Peeves. I think it's Peeves. And yeah, it's like you just don't know about those things when you're playing without any guidance as a child. But yeah, I really wish they could remaster all the Harry Potter games, make one big edition, and everyone will play it. I can tell you. But first, they're gonna do Legacy. I was suspecting they might remaster the games before Hogwarts Legacy because they tend to do that to hype it up. And people play it because they are anticipating the next version. So, yeah. But we'll see if it's popular. I'm sure people are going to be very hard on it. Like Brett said, I can't imagine people will be easy on this new game. I'm hoping it's good. I'm hoping.
Yeah, it's open world where you can pick your house. That'll be fun enough. With the next Witcher game, I hope that it doesn't follow just one person and we do it. I hope it's open world. It takes us hundreds of years in the past. And we get to pick our Witcher school. And you can be a cat school, you can be a bear school, wolf, manticore, whatever ones else they have in the CDPR lore. Something like that would just be amazing. And as long as the gameplay is somewhat fun, I'm going to have a blast with it. I just want that freedom, yo, that individual kind of to do it and have an overall the same story of like Harry Potter. But if you pick Ravenclaw, it's going to be a lot more problem solving, puzzles. You have to use your mind. It's not as much combat. If you're Gryffindor or Slytherin, you know, maybe more of that. And like Hufflepuff, it'll be a lot more emphasis on relationships with people. Something like that, again, could be really cool. That is sounds like it's really hard to do and a lot easier said than done. But if they do something like that, that would just be unbelievable to me.
I'm so excited for it. Yeah, that's true. It's been a long time.
Like, I've heard a rumor once about it, and it was always my dream to have an RPG in the Harry Potter world. And I saw this really badly taken photo of someone who claimed to have played it in a shop where people were testing it on, and they took a photo of it on a phone, and it looked so cool. I couldn't imagine it was fake. And even back then, they were doing these secret little testing on groups of people. And when they did the trailer for Legacy, it looked very similar to that game. So I think they know how much is at stake here. Like, they can't screw this one up because there's only one of these, and people will forever be fans of Harry Potter, so they have to. They took their time, so I'm hoping it's right now. And they even now postponed the release, so I'm glad they did that. Don't want a cyberpunk fiasco, of course.
Yeah, it was supposed to come out last year, and it got delayed to 2022. Really? Yeah, and then I think it was within like a week or two ago that a report came out that it was delayed until 2023. Well, they then officially put out things saying, no, it is still online for 2022. Now, as we've seen from every single major game, they not only get delayed once, they get delayed multiple times. So I still will be surprised if it's out by Christmas. But at the same time, I think they would know you release this massive Harry Potter game at Christmas, it's going to sell like crazy. But I do think, as you mentioned, Tia, that the Cyberpunk release was a watershed moment in gaming that no matter what, do not release a broken game. Delay it 10 times if you need to. So maybe that was it. Maybe they would have thrown it out by now, but they looked at that and were like, oh, we can't do that. We can't have that again. Because they didn't have the goodwill of like set a Project Red either. So yeah, it should be good. And so that is our Harry Potter tangent. That is why people maybe come to this podcast, because again, we'll go off on this. But again, it's something we could talk about all the time. I do think there's really only one thing left from this episode, because this is a Witcher podcast. Remember, if you somehow moved it to the middle and heard that, just like, oh, they uploaded the wrong episode. But no, the last one is at the very end, they're going to execute Kyre, which was really weird to me, because Kyre was like a commanding general type. He's a high-ranking noble. That's a very valuable asset to have as a prisoner, and I know they couldn't break into his mind, but just to execute him is like such a waste. Like, they could get something out of that, but I guess those kings and queens want to see a beheading. But I don't know, that just was kind of weird to me from like my historical angle.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way, to be honest. I just thought they wanted, you know, they had an Nilfgaardian and they want to send back his head to show strength, as Vilgefortz said. But yeah, that's an interesting take.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big thing from, like, medieval battles. You don't want to kill the high-ranking nobles. You don't want to kill the king because they are worth, I mean, a ransom. Mm. Like, they are worth so much. And they're noble. They're not these other peasants or something like that. They shouldn't be slaughtered on a battlefield. You know, you take them in and it's just, oh, shit. I bet I'm going to have 20,000, whatever. I don't even know what's that, gold, whatever it is. And so that's just a huge thing to have them as that captive. So I don't know. Again, maybe they just, the bloodthirst there. Some other people have other things in mind.
It just made me question the Brotherhood again, because Yennefer had this conversation with Cahir when he said, well, you're going to kill me. And she said something along the lines of they do everything for a reason, so they won't kill him. I can't remember her exact words, but then all of a sudden they decide to kill him. And as we know, it was the decision of Stregobor to test Yennefer, and it was likely him who suggested to kill Cahir. So immediately I completely doubted the whole reason for killing Cahir there, especially that Yen had to do it. To me, it felt more like we have to test Yennefer than actually we have to kill Cahir. So I'm glad she didn't. Though her goose is fried now, I don't think she can be trusted by Stregobor.
Well, literally, Stregobor was like, she's a traitor, she's going to betray us. And everyone was like, nah, she won't. And then she does, which again hit on, Lucy, you mentioned, Tisea's look as she rides away is just utter betrayal. And that was great. The reasoning, as you mentioned, Tia, was kind of suspect and kind of weird. But that shot on Tisea of that betrayal was just absolutely perfect.
Yeah, I agree. Like, she doesn't even have to say anything in that moment. You just know from her face that she is devastated by this. But I agree. Yeah, I think it makes more sense for the reasoning to be to test Yennefer over killing Cahir. They probably think it's, well, if it was Stregobor that suggested it, then yeah, it's probably him getting a reason to get rid of Yennefer, and he's probably not bothered about Cahir.
Yeah, I felt bad for Cahir for some reason, even though, well, you're very human if all your power is stripped away. So it's like he's useless now. I kill him. You know, it's like you said, Brett, he's worth more alive at this point. So, yeah, it felt very odd. And that's one of the few moments I like Yennefer doing something for maybe not power, but just because she won't do it because you said she has to do it. So she's just doing the exact opposite thing now and saving Cahir for no real reason that I can think of. It didn't help her cause.
Yeah, I was going to say it slowed her down, if anything.
Yeah.
By doing it, and you're right. Why would she? I get freeing him to cause, actually, maybe not. I don't know. Causing the scene is fine. You're going to escape. Freeing him, and then especially as you know these mages are coming after you, you stop to get him on there. I mean, obviously the thing would be it's self-preservation. This is a well-connected guy that maybe can help you in some way. Because you're right, she just turned her back on the Brotherhood. Is she actually going to go towards Nilfgaard now, who she just won a battle against? So it throws, you know, a coin up in the air to kind of guess what it may happen. But it was at least a fantastical ending, spectacle-wise at least. If there's one thing that I love to talk about and won't shut up about, it is outfits. Wait, that's Lucy's note, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much to say except for Yennefer's outfits this episode. We've got the dress and the executioner outfit were just divine, darling, divine.
The executioner one was great, too, because we hadn't seen it, right, before anything?
I don't think so.
Okay, so it's literally, okay, well, if I have to cut someone's head off, get that tailor ready, because I'm going to at least look good doing it. And I'm just like, that is a very Yen thing to do. So that was very spot on for her character across all canon.
And I do believe they changed the Nilfgaard armor, did they not? I think the fans were very happy with it being changed a little bit. Both to me looked really cool, if I'm going to be honest. I mean, this is sort of a fantasy world, and I like the armor being all out. But yeah, I was a fan of season 2's Nilfgaard armor as well. Very happy with that, I'd say. And Tisea's hair. No, not Tisea, Triss's hair. That was interesting. Controversial discussion there whether they caved in and made it red because people were complaining about the casting of the actor. But I liked how it looked. I liked the first season as well. But this looked well, I think, on Triss.
Yeah, I think the red hair looks amazing. Like, she looks stunning with it. But I was kind of annoyed that they kind of pandered to the complaints a little bit. So I'm a bit back and forth with that decision. But it looks incredible.
Here's the thing about Witcher lore and consistency and all of that. Let me put it as succinct as possible. The author, Andrzej Sapkowski, does not give a fuck about it. He does not care at all. And I'm telling you, the only time that dude smiles is when he hears some dorks argue about, like, Witcher lore. Because the dude does not care. He changes up so many things throughout the books. And when people ask him about it, he gives, like, a Harrison Ford response of, like, what the fuck are you, like, who cares? Like, why are you talking about that? And one thing about Triss is, and it's translations as well, because it's in Polish, you get it translated to other ones. In the English translation, Triss has chestnut brown hair throughout the entire books until her basically last scene at the very end when he's described as red. And so it's that's the thing. It's like even he calls it red at the end. It's like, okay, maybe he just liked redheads. Maybe his wife dyed her hair or something, or he saw somebody and was like, oh, I like redheads now. Ooh, Triss, she's young and hot. Let's give her red hair. And that's what I'm saying. So when people get so hung up on like Triss's hair color, when she's introduced, it's chestnut brown. It's also mentioned as auburn, which is kind of reddish orange, but definitely not like fiery red. To everybody out there, I beg of you, the author, the creator of this universe, does not fucking care. So stop arguing about it. Like, I could just imagine him just laughing as these dorks are just talking to each other.
He would be.
Yes, he would be, because he's just a complete curmudgeon. And it's just so funny. Like I've said before, he never had an official map, like ever. Yeah. There was never an official Witcher map in there because he did not care. His geography at times, you scratch your head going, wait, I thought it was here. I thought it was here. He doesn't care. It's not George R. R. Martin, you know, pulling out this history. We're never going to really have that. There's my second rant that I got a little hot on. But y'all, just chill when it comes to that stuff like that. She does look good. Everybody looks good. We talked about that before. This is like the hottest TV series like ever. That's something Netflix seems to do. Keep that up. But again, there's my spiel. I'm sorry.
Don't apologize.
All right, so super long episode today. A lot of good tangents. But again, that's why y'all are here. If there's anything you want to hear from an upcoming episode that you want us to hit on, by all means, let us know. Again, we're not talking about every single thing, but there's some scene or character or anything, just let us know at Twitter, at Witcher Podcast, or you can email us, witcherpod@gmail.com. Best one would be Twitter, though, because we both are on the account. We'll see it a lot of times of the day because of the hour change. We'll definitely get back to you on there, and it could start a decent discussion. Tia, thank you again for joining us. Much appreciated. Where can people find you?
Firstly, thanks for having me, Lucy and Brett. It was super fun being on your podcast. And where people can find me, well, it's just my name most of the time. On Twitter, it's Tia Boysen. On Twitch, it's Tia Beastie. And on YouTube, it's Tia Beastie Boysen. I'm not sure how that happened, but it appears to be canon now. I'm too lazy to change it.
Jeez, okay.
But, yeah, well, you'll find it just mix the words. Beastie should do the trick.
There you go. And of course, we will have all those links below. Again, a bunch of good Gwent content, new Witcher 3 content, other stuff as well as you variety stream at times as you are big time Twitch partner there. There you go. There you go.
We'll get the life.
Yeah, we'll get Lucy there. We'll get Lucy there eventually. Again, thanks for joining us. And because you're such a big Witcher 3, we would obviously love to have you on again as we get back to that main quest here in probably a couple of months. So if you'd like to come back, we would love to have you.
I would love to come back, so it's a date.
Perfect.
There we go.
You are now on the record recorded, so you have to do it. You are contractually obligated. All right. Lucy, where can we find you?
I'm Lucy J. Robin on Twitter, Twitch, Instagram, most things, I think. And we'll pop my Discord link in the show notes as well.
You can find me at TheFoxBride4 on Twitter or on Twitch at TheFoxBride. Join us next time as we have yet another special guest on to discuss episode 4 of the season, Redanian Intelligence.